Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Air Force Colonel Valerie Long about the role that Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany has played in evacuation efforts from Afghanistan and their ongoing work with thousands of evacuees. But first, we're going to focus on Haiti. On August 14th, a major earthquake struck the country's southwestern peninsula, leaving more than 2,200 people dead, thousands more wounded, and tens of thousands of people homeless. Shortly after the earthquake struck, a tropical storm bore down on the island, making conditions far worse. All of this is happening with an interim government in charge following the assassination of Haiti's president in July, and of course, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. This disaster has been largely overshadowed by other major events dominating the news. And to help us understand what's happening in Haiti and what the needs are there, Dimi Dureska is here. He's an associate professor and director of the Institute for International Business at the Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa. He was also born and raised in Haiti and is chairman of the board for Community Health Initiative Haiti, an international nonprofit that was founded in Iowa City. Dimi, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And Dimi, this earthquake actually struck the part of the country that you're from, right?
That's exactly right. I was born and raised in Lekai, Haiti. And we always say that, I'm from down south, down Lekai. So that's how we said it. And it was so sad to see the destructions of my high school, which will not be able to host students this school year, and my neighborhood completely, you know, flattened, and very few houses are standing. It's definitely it's devastating, and as a Cayenne, as we said, someone from Lekai, I it was just, you know, at first I was shocked. And then in the middle of things, I became kind of like speechless. Then after that, I was just mad. I was mad for several reasons. And I kept saying, why Haiti? You know, as you said in your introduction, early July, we had the assassination of the president. Then, you know, we had an interim government. Things are still in limbo on the political side. And you have this earthquake that hit the country, followed by a tropical storm that poured heavy rains in the southern peninsula for several days. So it's just, you know, combinations of several things that put the country in a situation that, you know, nobody asked for.
Yeah.
So.
And after years and years of crises like this, I mean, I think we all, of course, remember the earthquake that devastated Haiti just 11 years ago. And can you, the southwestern part of the country is not the part of the country that people outside of Haiti tend to hear the most about. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Just put it in context for us.
Of course. Yeah. It's in the south of Port-au-Prince, about 120 miles away from Port-au-Prince. And then if you go all the way south, you reach kind of like the tip of the island that look across Cuba. And it's not because I'm from the south, but I'm going to say something here. We have the most beautiful beaches in Haiti with very green. I mean, it's really where the green and the blue meet together, which means lots of trees and then the sea. I mean, when you are driving from Port-au-Prince to Lekai, you start with the sea on your right, and then when you finish in Lekai, you end up with the sea on your left, and it's very blue, and people are very hospitable. I mean, as you can see me, as Charity, when you see me in Iowa City, I'm always smiling. So because I got the southern hospitality, you know, and it's the part that's very quiet. We always say, those of us from Lekai, we are from the south of Haiti, we are quiet. But when we you know, decide to rise up for something, that means it's serious. Okay, we always take time before we rise up for something, but when we do, that means it's serious. Actions need to be taken, and we, you know, and it's a town that lots of rice plantations but lately lots of people from rural areas, they move to to Lekai, which is kind of like the biggest city, about 60,000 people. So when I grew up in Lekai, it was about 30,000. So now Lekai is about 60,000 people, and really, I mean, people live on everyday basis on commercial activities, and agriculture is not happening in the city, but it's happening around the city. And kind of like in remote areas and things.
And Dimi, in the wake of this earthquake, I'm sure that all communication networks went down. How were you getting information about what was happening in Lekai and in the surrounding area?
Surprisingly, Charity, this time around, communication has been a lot better as opposed to 2010. With technology, a lot of people have access to smartphone, and therefore are connected via WhatsApp. So I can tell you, within minutes of the earthquake, you know, while I was waking up here on that Saturday morning around 6 o'clock, my WhatsApp message, my WhatsApp inbox started being flooded with messages. Earthquake in Lekai, earthquake in Haiti. You know, I have people in the Dominican Republic sending a message. I have people in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, in Lekai sending me messages. And then I quickly called my sister in Port-au-Prince, and I asked her, what is going on? And she told me about the earthquake. And then my aunt, who still lived in Lekai, in the house that I grew up in, and I asked my sister, have you been able to get in touch with my aunt? She said, I have not been able to get in touch with her because my aunt, what she does for a living, she's 72 years old, but she still goes to the public market to sell goods. So she had already left the house and went to the public market. Luckily, she had done that because there is kind of like some outside walls of that house that got cracked, and one of them fell. So she could have been, you know, in serious danger. So, but she managed to get out of the public market, which also got several cracks. And since then, everybody in that neighborhood, everybody in my neighborhood, they're living in the streets, you know, and the tropical storm, you know, they were all there, you know, getting wet, you know, being pulled on by water and everything. And so really, with the rise of WhatsApp, with social media, communications happen in real time, but one thing though you have to be cautious about, there were lots of also miscommunications, people kind of like using the social media for you know, to propagate news that we would say are not true. So yeah. But I had a lot of reliable sources on the ground, people I grew up with, and community leaders, neighborhood leaders that I communicated with, and I've been communicating with them since then, that I can find reliable information so I can connect other people with where they can find help, or if I want to send help myself, I know where to send them.
So we only have a couple of minutes left, Dimi, and in just a moment I'm going to visit with a nurse practitioner who's on the ground in Haiti helping people. But tell us what the needs are right now and what people can do from the United States to help.
Well, as you said in your introduction, I'm the chair of a locally based organization, Community Health Initiative for Haiti. And what we've been doing, we haven't sent anybody under the name of the organization to Haiti, but we've been getting medical supplies and medications down there to local hospitals, local clinics that are there helping. And we also been sending clean water filtrations to the people that are in need of that. So what I would say whatever organizations that you support that work in Haiti, they need, if you are sending them donations, make sure you tell them if they need to buy medical supplies, medications, you know, clean water, and food. So food is very important. That's what we've been doing with CHI. And now I would say this year or this earthquake, local responders, local doctors, local nurse practitioners, they have done a tremendous job by, you know, providing the emergency cares that were needed. And kudos to them. And I know you're going to talk to one very shortly. But right now, what people need is medical supplies, meds, and things of that sort. I was just in the Dominican Republic. In fact, I came back last night. I coordinated the shipment of some tarps, some tents, and flashlights, and water purification kits that that are going to be sent to my neighborhood, you know, people that need. And I also sent a generator so they can use to charge their phones, to charge their rechargeable flashlights and things like that. So those are the things that are needed. But send money to organizations that can buy them. Don't try to send those things to Haiti. If you want to send to CHI, Community Health Initiative for Haiti, it's chihaiti.org. And on our website, you'll find how to donate to earthquake relief in Haiti.
Dimi, we have less than a minute left. Does it feel like people have forgotten about Haiti? It really has been overshadowed by so many other things in the news.
Certainly. And I keep hearing also the things of Haiti fatigue, because it's like every couple years something is going on in Haiti. But I can tell people it's nothing that's going on in Haiti is caused by the Haitian people. The Haitian people, always welcoming, always hospitable. They are very resilient. And I know it's a cliche about Haiti, but I can tell you, Haitian people are very resilient, and they will, you know, surmount this tragedy, and they will pick themselves up and do things in the right way. And remember, we are the first Black republic in the world. If we had managed to defeat the Napoleon army back in 1804,
you can recover from this.
Dimi, we can recover from this one.
Thank you so much, Dimi Dereska. We've been talking about Haiti. More in a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later on the show, I'll talk with Air Force Colonel Valerie Long. She's stationed at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, where they've welcomed over 20,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. But right now, we are focusing on Haiti and the aftermath of the terrible earthquake that struck on August 14th, leaving more than 2,200 people dead and thousands more injured and or homeless. Regan Louie is also a board member of Community Health Initiative of Haiti, but Louie is also a nurse practitioner and educator who, in addition to teaching nursing at Faculty of Nursing Science of the Episcopal University of Haiti, volunteers in clinics throughout urban and rural Haiti. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Regan.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And take us back to August 14th. Where were you when the earthquake struck?
I was home. And I was actually going to a gas station to get some fuel. And as I was getting closer to park, then I felt the car I was on was kind of shaking with me. And I didn't understand what was going on. I thought it was just a dump truck or a tanker coming by shaking the roads until I saw people running in its direction. Then I understood that it was an earthquake.
How close were you to the epicenter of the quake?
Actually, I felt it pretty bad, but I was not that close. Unfortunately, the earthquake was felt all over the country, but mostly the southern part of Haiti was where the epicenter was, which was about, I would say, a 6 hour drive south of where I was.
And tell me what it was like to realize how bad the earthquake was for the people in that region. When did you get that news?
Well, when I felt it, because I experienced an earthquake about 11 years ago, and I live in Laogan, which was the epicenter of the previous earthquake we have, the most recently we have before this one. So I was shocked, and I'm like, where was it? And I didn't know until later. Then I heard that it was affected the people in the south part of the country. And I got a chance to go and assess the situation as part of a board member of CHI to see how we could get some assistance to the people the same day.
When you went to assess the situation, can you tell me what you saw?
Well, it was not as bad it was for the one we have, even though it was bigger, because the area that is affected by this current earthquake is a little bit more rural than Laogan or Port-au-Prince. Like, the infrastructure are different. They're mostly wooden structures, and they're not, the building are not as close as they are in Port-au-Prince and in Laogan. So in terms of injured people and collapsed houses, the affection is still critical, but compared to what I've experienced before, it's a little bit less. And what I have found is that the people are more aware, like they are more aware of the behavior they should have in front of an earthquake compared to before. They didn't know, this generation have not experienced an earthquake before. So that's why we have so many deaths during the first earthquake. And now we have fewer deaths because force of the building and of the population over there, which is not as concentrated as where I live. And also the education they earned from the previous earthquake we had.
Yeah, people know what to do now. Of course, right after the earthquake, you had a tropical storm bearing down on you as well. What was that like?
Well, I call it like the package. You know, it's almost like the same situation we had, where we had an earthquake and then we had, you know, an epidemic, and then we had an hurricane after that. So it's like a nonstop drama TV show kind of. So, I mean, patients have a sense of, I would call it resiliency or resistance to really difficult situation. And I mean, it's just difficult to imagine someone, you know, scared of his home, not trying to stay inside if it's 10 after the quake. So sleeping outside with no shelters. And then now you're facing a hurricane. So, I mean, it was really sad to see how the people, have to accommodate quickly, which didn't really happen. So people had to sleep outside on the rain. Because we were still having aftershock and then rain, and then it was all of that. And still, people still in need of shelters, in need of food, in need of medical care. I mean, right now, there are some coordination going on to meet those needs, but it's just taking time.
Well, let's talk about people's needs. We know that more than 2,200 people died in the earthquake, and we also know that thousands more were injured. So even though this earthquake was not as bad as the one that happened 11 years ago, it's still incredibly difficult. Is that your focus as a nurse practitioner on making sure that people get the medical care that they need?
Yes. First of all, with the experience I had with the, it's like the aura I felt, like it's like I'm hallucinating of what I've experienced 11 years ago, because I was just graduating from nursing school, and our nursing school was transformed into like a battlefield hospital. And I was freshly graduated. I was doing all kinds of stuff after that. So this picture came in my mind, and I said, wow, I need to go there, because the earthquake isn't like making the situation, the people he's living right now. It's just aggravating it. It's just making it worse. So I know that, because I have experienced through CHI, working in that area, doing medical trips and, you know, promoting health in that area. So when the reason it is important, first of all, to assess the situation is because the first week or the first hours count a lot in terms of emergency. Like people had, you know, like immediate medical needs, which, by example, in 2010, when we had the earthquake and Laogan, the aids or the medical aids was a little bit delayed because of that. Some people were amputated. So because of that, then we felt the call that we had to go there and we had to help, and we had to help especially those who are not able to make it to the existing hospital, which of only fewer.
This time, of course, you're also in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. What has that changed in your efforts to help people?
Right now, like I said, it's the situation of Haiti is kind of a little bit forgotten, but it's very complicated. We are in the middle of a gang fight which terrorizes the population. We are in the middle of a natural disaster, earthquake and hurricane. We're also in the middle of a pandemic, which, and also we just had our president murdered, right, and we still don't know yet what happened. So there are so many topics on the table. We just don't know what to put first, you know? So it's a great question. Actually, with my medical background, I can tell that right now we are, I think, yesterday we suspect that, because there are so many people heading to the hospital right now. I think right now the Delta variant is kind of hitting the Haitian. We were spared by the previous variant a little bit, but now most of the COVID centers are not focusing on, you know, like the epidemiology or the pandemic. But right now, I'm seeing a lot of people complaining of symptoms related to COVID, and some of them are in bad shape. So, I mean, maybe very soon this would be, you know, brought up as a big topic, but like I said, there are so much going on that unfortunately we're not truly focusing on COVID right now, because there are fewer people wearing masks and social distancing doesn't exist, and it's just a difficult situation.
I'm talking with Regan Louis, a board member of Community Health Initiative of Haiti, also a nurse practitioner and educator who teaches other nurses in Haiti. And Regan, let's talk about some of the other needs that go along with an earthquake, because, of course, infrastructure is damaged. People's homes are damaged. Do people have, for example, clean water to drink?
The food situation, water situation, education, security has always been a problem prior to the earthquake. The earthquake is just complicating the situation. So most of the area, CHI is currently trying to monitor to see where is the most needed area. They all have one thing in common: food, water, and healthcare. So like I said, there are a few groups trying to coordinate the needs with the government, but it's just delaying because it's just complicated to coordinate for those areas, and the needs are still great.
In the past, Haiti has had some really just so many challenges, but also mistreatment by people coming in from the outside to help. You are obviously a Haitian man who is trained to be a helper within the country. Tell me what the situation is like as far as groups from outside coming in to help. Are they there?
Yes, there are some groups like CHA has, I mean, represented by his local staff right now, which I'm part of. But there are also some outsiders which are already here too. And this time, I think, like I said, we have learned a little bit from the previous earthquake. So the government flew a group called Civil Protection. They tried to register any groups, like any institution, we would like to bring some assistance, any kind. So they would identify the area where the needs are for the specific aids that they will bring. So I kind of congratulate the government for doing this, because the previous experience we had was, it was like people walking on top of each other, like, you know, the help was concentrated in Port-au-Prince or nearby, but it wasn't spread out, especially to the remote region, like to the area where it was difficult to reach, where access was very difficult. But this time, I think it's better, but except it's the need is so great, it's just a little bit slow.
What do you think people who are listening to this in Iowa could do to help?
Like you can see in all my answers, I'm focusing on the earthquake, but I'm also focusing on Haiti in general. I think people in Iowa and people in the world, they need to pay a little bit more attention to the degradation of, I would say, the civilian life and right in Haiti. Because, I mean, we are surrounded by violence and insecurity. And I think this has reached its limit. And it's just too much. So I think people can support the effort of some organization to promote healthcare in Haiti and support the economy by creating some jobs. And, you know, and this is one of the things that CHI has been doing for the last 11 years. So I think the world has, I wouldn't say has forgot Haiti, but I think Haiti need a little bit more attention, because I think the Haiti needs a promising future, especially for the youth, and especially right now that we are in the middle of a natural disaster crisis. But I think Haiti can't breathe that way anymore. Something needs to be done for Haiti.
What will you be doing today?
Right now, I am collecting some bucket of, it's like a water filter system that CHI has had purchased from a local company. I'm picking up about 200 of those with some chlorine. And we are heading to a city called Les Anglais, which is at the tip of the peninsula down south where the earthquake was affected, which was affected by the earthquake. And we're going to distribute those. And also we're going to also bring in some food in that area. So I'm waiting for a team to pick me up, and then we'll be heading that way. We're going to spend the rest of the week there, and also running some medical clinic as well.
Well, Regan, I hope that that effort goes well. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Regan Louis is a nurse practitioner and an educator who lives and works in Haiti. He's also a board member of Community Health Initiative Haiti, and he is working to help those in his home country recover from the recent earthquake, tropical storm, and so many disasters that have struck one after another. To find out more about the work that CHI Haiti is doing, you can go to chihaiti.org. Coming up in a moment, we will shift our focus to Afghanistan. Actually, by traveling to Germany, I'll have a conversation with Air Force Colonel Valerie Long. She's stationed at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, where they have welcomed over 20,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Yesterday afternoon, a plane took off from the airport in Kabul, Afghanistan, carrying the last of the U.S. troops, ending a 20-year U.S. military presence in the country. The world has watched for the last 2 weeks as U.S. forces work to evacuate Americans and Afghan allies from the country following the collapse of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. The evacuees have been carried to different places of refuge around the world, including Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. At Ramstein, they have welcomed more than 20,000 evacuees, and my next guest has been a witness to this incredible effort. Air Force Colonel Valerie Long is stationed at Ramstein now. She grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and full disclosure, is one of my oldest and dearest friends. In her career, she was also deployed to Afghanistan twice and spent more than a year and a half there. She's on the line with me now. Hello, Valerie.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for talking with me. And I became aware of this incredible effort because you have been sharing some of these stories on Facebook. And I was looking at the Facebook page for Ramstein Air Force Base, and this seemed to all begin with clearing the parking lots. Can you tell me how the base was transformed when you discovered that you would be getting evacuees from Afghanistan?
Right. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show. I love to be able to share this story. We've been working so hard here. We are probably just under 2 weeks into this whole effort, right? And Ramstein is a busy base normally, but this is totally out of the ordinary for what we do, right? And so 2 weeks ago, we had to start finding some place on this base to fit up to like 20,000 of these evacuees from Afghanistan. And yeah, I don't know that we all understood the scope of it as we were getting started, but we started just with the resources we had here. And then it's really been a team effort trying to get this base ready to receive and take care of all of these refugees.
So it started with starting to collect things that the evacuees might need, but also with building housing. Where have they been sleeping? Where have they been living?
Well, if you really, we've set up a city out on our flight line. We have tents. We have a lot of tents. We've got over, 100 or so tents. Yes, about 100 tents, I think, probably more. And we've had to set up basically everything you can think of in a small city within just a couple days.
Well,
so,
I can imagine that the people who have arrived at the airbase have very little with them. What are their needs?
Well, you're right. Many of them show up with just the clothes on their back. And we've been collecting food, clothing, toys for the kids. I've seen a lot of soccer balls, all sorts, basically hygiene items, anything that if you are trying to just take care of so many people that, you know, it's been amazing to see how people have stepped up to donate, right? And so we've got a donation center set up here on base and volunteers sorting through all of these donations to put together care packages to hand out to the evacuees when they show up.
Well, just to get them clothed. And many people not only showed up with just the clothes on their backs, but actually with nothing on their feet, barefoot.
True. Wow. Yes. Shoes have been a big need, shoes and socks. And the climate here is different than in Afghanistan. It has been a little bit cooler and rainier. So hats, glove, coats, All of those kinds of items have been in big need, and really the area here, not just military, but here in Germany, are really stepping up and donating those items.
How have you been able to feed all of these people? I mean, it's one thing to put up housing, but that's a lot of meals every day.
It really is, yes. So, like yesterday, I packed grab and go lunches. Actually, I had a free hour in my schedule, and there were large volunteer efforts putting together kind of bags of food, just snacks. And then we have we've worked with our German partners here to set up, you know, contracts to bring in food and really get warm meals to our evacuees.
And feeding people has turned into a 24-hour-a-day operation.
It is. It really is. Yes. The volunteer effort here is 24/7. Absolutely. And yeah, people show up on flights. The flights could come in the middle of the night. You're not going to want to, you know, you don't want to wait to feed people when, you know, in the morning, right? Right. People are hungry and need support right as they get in. So now, that's where we're meeting them.
As the eyes of the world have been on this evacuation process, one of the things that happened en route to Ramstein Air Force Base really went viral. It was a story that I saw everywhere about an mm-hmm. Afghan woman who gave birth en route to the Air Force Base. That's a story that I think gave people so much joy and so much hope. What are some of the other things that you've been hearing about, the connections that people are making with some of the evacuees?
Yeah, every evacuee who shows up here has a story, right? And besides we've had many babies born here, that definitely brings hope and joy. And one of the things that we're working on here too is there's unaccompanied minors, so we are really working to support that effort to get them reunited with their family. That's not our piece of it. We're just taking care of them, making sure that they're safe and cared for. But just knowing that there's hope for some of these children touches my heart.
Well, and I can imagine with so many children around, there have been all kinds of spontaneous things happening in addition to people doing their duties. Do you see members of the Air Force playing soccer and spending time with the kids?
Absolutely. Yes. I think, you know, I've seen and heard of a lot of soccer games, volleyball games, playing catch, just being there for these kids has been one of the highlights, I think, for a lot of our members.
So I mentioned you've had over 20,000 evacuees. Over 8,000 have already moved on, have flown to the United States. Do you even have an idea of how long this effort is going to last as people get processed and go to where they're going to go? Do you know how long you'll have a village or a city on base?
You know, we don't really know that. I know that we are prepared to do this humanitarian effort until it is no longer needed. But yeah, we don't really know how long it's gonna be lasting. Our effort here is, you know, to take care of them and then move them as quickly as we can onto their final destinations.
This must have been a real shift. Obviously, you have duties and many things going on the Air Force Base every day, and to suddenly shift into this operation, what has that meant for the kinds of things that you normally do?
You know, like I said, this place is usually very busy, and a lot of that has continued. So we still do have operations that we are supporting. This is really over and above that. But of course, there have been, as you've seen on some of the Facebook pages, that there have been some impacts just to our how we run some of our services. But really, I think the really amazing thing that I've seen is that even though some of the hours are shortened on different services, people seem to understand that and are really the volunteers here are really pitching in to help out, like at the post office and various things like that, just to keep things running.
Now, I can imagine that a lot of the people that you are stationed with, a lot of the people that you work with, have been in Afghanistan. How does that affect their involvement in this mission and thinking about having served there?
Yeah, I really, a lot of us have been in Afghanistan, and I think that makes this mission just that much more personal to us. You know, a lot of us have Afghan friends while we were there, making those connections and being able to help them and their families has really meant a lot.
Now, you yourself spent over a year and a half in Afghanistan, and I wonder from that time, obviously being there in an official capacity as part of the Air Force is a little bit different than living in a country abroad. But from your time in Afghanistan, what do you think you really learned about the country and the people?
Oh, well, so much. But, I really learned just how, I don't even really know how to put it, but just how I want to say family oriented, how important that is to the Afghans. And yeah, just how much they really care. And, being involved now in this is just one way we can kind of help and sort of turn that and care for them in a way, So yeah, just really how important that is to the Afghans and their culture. So yeah.
I've been watching, as many of my journalist friends, new Afghans, those who have spent time covering the war in Afghanistan over the years, and people were very carefully watching to make sure that their friends were safe and made it out, or lending support if they possibly could. Is that something that is common among the people that you work with? You mentioned a lot of them have friends in Afghanistan, have, friends who are allies who supported the services. Have there been a lot of people trying to make connections with people they care about?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen a lot of people who have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, making sure, just trying to keep tabs and really help as they can to make contact, make sure that their Afghan friends understand processes and who to talk to so that they could leave the country if that's what they wanted to do. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of that. It's been hard, though.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm sure it's been an emotional time for you. Absolutely. And for a lot of people. What have you been finding yourself? Obviously, you've thrown yourself into pack and grab and go lunches and anything that you can when you're not working. But what's been going through your mind?
It's in a way, having this humanitarian effort to focus on has really, I think for a lot of us, really given us something that we can, really be proud of as we do this. We're solely focused on taking care of these evacuees and getting them where they need to go. So it's really given us a purpose, which is really great.
When you reflect on your time in Afghanistan, do you have a memory or something that you return to that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the relationships and friends that I made while I was over there is, you know, that is, you know, just kind of the bedrock. But and this is a little bit random, but I just remember I've got several memories of just how beautiful the place is. Just the roses in Afghanistan are amazing. And so sometimes when I'm thinking about Afghanistan, I'll just think about a certain garden that I saw while I was there. And it's a beautiful country.
I think that that's something that a lot of us far, far, far away and on the outside really don't see. We see the images that we see on the news, and that's not a part of what we see of Afghanistan. That must be. Does that bother you sometimes to think that people don't really understand that country?
Well, of course, right? And, you know, we do, as the military, we've been there for so long, right? But there's some really beautiful aspects of that country that it does bother me. I wish people could understand that. But, you know, that's what it is.
So your days and nights, I'm sure, have all been turned a little bit upside down on base. What is the atmosphere like on base? I mean, obviously, there's a great deal of work to do. But with so many children around, with people working to keep people entertained as well as fed and cared for, what kinds of things are you seeing that you thought you would never see on an Air Force base?
Oh, gosh. A lot of this, right? So what I've found really amazing is that people who have various, like, different talents that you wouldn't think would come into play. There was a band out on the flight line providing entertainment. There's a self-organizing sewing group that is doing all they can to make headscarves and prayer rugs. Like, all of these things that you don't really think about until you need those things. Right. And people just are stepping up and doing them.
Well, you've been in the Air Force now for, gosh, almost 28 years, I think, if my math is correct. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I have not. I am so just proud to be a part of it. But yeah, this is truly unique in my career.
Wow. Well, and I'm sure you have memories that you will carry with you for a lifetime.
Absolutely.
Well, Valerie, thank you so much for sharing what you're seeing and experiencing with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Air Force Colonel Valerie Long, she is stationed now at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, where they have welcomed more than 20,000 evacuees. More than 8,000 have already flown on to wherever their destinations are, but they are supporting them with food, with clothing, and so many other things. It's a major operation. If you go to the Ramstein Air Force Base on Facebook, you can see many pictures from this operation. And of course, as I mentioned, some of the stories from the Air Force Base have gone viral as they're experiencing all kinds of life with evacuees from Afghanistan. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Matt Alvarez, Dennis Reese, Rick Brewer, and Zachary Oren Smith. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You never need to miss an episode. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And please subscribe to the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast as well. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.